Everybody, welcome. I'm Rita McGrath. You probably knew that. My guest today is Jeremy Utley, who is a participant in Stanford's Design School, an entrepreneur, and for purposes of today, an author of this terrific book, Idea Flow, which is all about how you can create the discipline of getting a consistent stream of great ideas and create a portfolio of ideas, which is really essential. Just a reminder to everybody, this is being recorded, so don't say anything you don't want your great Aunt Sally to know about. And without further ado, we do keep an eye on the chat, but I may not get to every question today, so we'll follow up after the session with responses as we can. So Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rita. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. And so great to be immersed in this great book, Idea Flow. So Jeremy and I first met at a PowerShift conference out in California. We were gathering together business people, artists, entrepreneurs, creative types, with the idea of really creating forging a better identity for that group and for the world. And I was so impressed with meeting him there. I followed up. And since then we've been in lots of different conversations. So I thought maybe just share a little bit about your journey, how you got to this place and how you came to write this book.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been a privilege to get to lead exec ed at the Stanford D School for the last, from 2010 to the end of last year. So about 13 years leading executive programs in the methodology that we pioneered at the D School, design thinking. And part of that time, I also co-led the Venture Accelerator. I also launched the D School's first hackathon, the D School's first online course, launched the Leadership Laboratory. I've done a lot of things at the D School. And the pandemic really gave me and my co-author and my co-instructor, Perry Claibon, a wonderful opportunity to take stock, because over the last, call it, dozen years at the time, we had the privilege of being invited into many organizations, scores of organizations, to build capacity around innovation. And through, honestly, a lot of our failures and some successes and things that we observed, we realized we have a unique perspective on this challenge of building the capacity to innovate. And the pandemic afforded us a wonderful opportunity to actually document and share it in a very different format. You know, a four-day workshop is one thing, but a 50,000-word book is a totally different animal. So it was a lot of fun to kind of switch genres or switch fields a little bit.
I love that. I love that. And I really like the book. I mean, it's full of great stories and wonderful examples and very kind of practical tips, you know, that people can put to work right away. And I think people sometimes get this wrong idea about innovation, that it's this, you know, magic happens and Steve Jobs arrives on the shore in a clamshell with a black turtleneck and, you know, boof. And right. As you and I both know very well, it's nothing. It couldn't be farther than that. It's a discipline. It's a discipline that you can learn. So let's start right at the beginning with, let's tell us about how you measure idea flow, because I think that's a really great way to ground the book.
Yeah, very simply, idea flow is a measure of the ideas that you can generate or your team can generate over time. You can do it very simply. You can measure your own idea flow by picking an email that you need to write today and setting a timer for 1 minute and saying, how many subject lines can you generate for this email? Ready, go. And in a minute, you can get a rough sense for your idea flow. The point is, more ideas lead to better ideas. And most people aren't oriented around more. And so the fundamental premise is quantity has, as they say, has a quality all its own.
Absolutely. Well, as I like to say, you know, really terrific ideas and really terrible ideas look almost identical at birth.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. And that's, I think that it's actually our aversion of bad ideas that actually holds us back, right? If I were to say to folks on the line right now, hey, write down a bad idea, it's actually really hard to do, because you pull out a post-it and you go, why am I doing that? This guy's stupid. You know, it's not even worth the post-it. I'll just wait till he explains why. You know, that's how most people interact with that prompt. And what we don't realize is that it's actually, I mean, the sociologist and philosopher Taylor Swift recently said in a iHeartRadio Innovator Awards acceptance speech, she said, I want young people to know, especially it's the hundreds or thousands of bad ideas that I've had, or sorry, she said dumb ideas that I've had that have led me to my good ideas. And it's actually that willingness to have and entertain and play with dumb ideas that leads to breakthroughs. And for a lot of people, they go, why am I not breaking through? The answer is actually, you aren't allowing yourself to be dumb.
Well, and I think so much of what we think of as a good idea, you know, is bounded by the reality of what exists today, right? And when you think about, I mean, I write a lot about strategic inflection points, and what they do is they change what's possible. And so what's a dumb idea in the context of, you know, 1990 could be suddenly a brilliant idea, you know, in 2023, because the world's changed. And so I think limiting yourself that way is very dangerous. And I think you make that point really, really well in the book. So you talk about, you know, what is an idea? What is an idea? And I love your example of two prompts, right? So young couple, heavy stroller, pushing it up a hill in San Francisco. And whoa, my dad, you know, had this electric powered lawnmower.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know,
fundamentally, and what human brains do is like oh, wow, electric powered buggy.
That's it. Right. And we all had this collective hallucination together. That's a new idea, right? That's one of the blessings of having four daughters. I have four young daughters, and they ask a lot of questions, and they ask me to define words that I think are obvious, right? And so, you know, I traffic in ideas. I'm often talking about ideas. An idea, it can become one of those words that actually loses meaning because we're all so used to it, right? But one time, one of my daughters asked, hey, Daddy, what is an idea? And I realized every time I started to explain it, I needed to then define another word I was using, which is a problem, right? If your definitions require definition, you're in trouble. And so I really challenged myself to come up with a definition that would suit Corey, who's now six. And what I realized as I studied the underlying neuroscience and the research on it is there's no such thing as a new idea, actually. Fundamentally, our brains can't create something from nothing. Ex nihilo creation, it doesn't happen here. It turns out when we have the impression of, or the kind of the perception of idea, what's happening neurologically is two places in our brain are coming together that hadn't come together before. And so the way I've described it is an idea is a connection. It's a connection between, importantly, two things you know. Not the, you can't connect what you don't know, but it's a novel connection. And when you realize an idea is just a connection, that's all it is. And you can almost think about, you know, Lego pieces, right? I give another example. We were working with which will remain nameless, a electric vehicle company that's looking at this problem of range anxiety, right? And that's a problem that plagues many prospective electric vehicle owners. And this engineer was telling me, she said, you know, I've been noodling on this challenge of range anxiety for a while. I go to a coffee shop and I couldn't help myself. I see a couple of military guys come in fatigues and I just started eavesdropping. I said, hey, don't apologize. Eavesdropping is a great creative strategy. That's awesome. And she said, they started talking about how jet fighters, they don't scramble back to the base when they need to refuel because they have small fuel tanks. They do what's called mid-air refueling. And she said, when I heard that, I go, oh. And everybody on the line right now, if you're conscious, we just collectively had this thing called an idea, right? Wait, range anxiety, mid-air refuel, you mean? And all we've done existentially, actually, you probably knew both of those. Probably 95% of the people on the line right now know both of those things existentially. But when we bring them in close enough proximity, they just snap together, almost like magnetiles. They just snap together. That's an idea. And when you realize that basically ideation is about connecting Lego pieces, all of a sudden you start valuing diverse perspectives differently. Why? Because they bring a different bag of Legos to the meeting, right? You start valuing inspiration differently. Why? Because they bring a different bag of Legos to the process of combinatorial play. And so knowing that an idea is a connection is actually, far from being kind of a semantic thing, is actually a profoundly helpful way to think about it.
I love that. Oh, I absolutely love that. And throughout the book, you talk about all the different ways that you can engage that, but also the things that can get in the way, right, of being able to make those connections. And toward the end of the book, you talk about the importance of withdrawal. And I thought that was so interesting. You know, stepping back and saying, yeah, I'm just not getting anywhere, banging away at this idea right now. I have to withdraw for a bit. And it connected to me with some of these really important concepts that we have, like in leadership, right? And I think it was Heifetz and his co-author who talked about the balcony and the dance floor, you know, that you need to engage and you get in the action, otherwise nothing happens. But you also need to get up to the balcony and right, take a step back. And I think you talk about that with the sort of resolving knotty problems.
No, it's probably my favorite topic, to be honest with you, Rita. And it's, to me, it's a shame that it's the last chapter of the book, because if you believe what publishers say, nobody reads the last chapter of the book. But my hope,
You're breaking my heart. What? I saved the very best for the last, and you mean they've been missing it all these years?
I think that's what they call burying the lead. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, no, I couldn't agree more. To me, it's my favorite chapter of the book, actually. And I was really inspired. You know, Danny Kahneman's old research partner, Amos Tversky, said something amazing. You know, you think about what Kahneman and Tversky did in basically rewriting the laws of economic theory and psychology as we know it, right? Prior to Kahneman and Tversky, we thought that human beings were rational, right? This is crazy. Someone asked Amos Tversky once, hey, how did you guys, I mean, if you think about their work output, they had a series of wildly inventive experiments, like truly incredible experiments. And someone asked Amos Tversky once, how did you and Danny do it? How'd you come up with so many inventive experiments? And I loved what Amos Tversky said. He said, the secret to doing good research, and by the way, I would substitute whatever your work is for the word research. Their work happened to be research, but you could say the secret to doing good teaching, the secret to doing good financial analysis, whatever it might be, is to always be a little underemployed. And then he went on to say, you waste years by not being able to waste hours.
Oh, that's fascinating.
He was referring to the fact that he and Kahneman would take these long ambling walks around Hebrew University there in Jerusalem, where they were rising stars. And they were known to laugh together. Imagine that, right? Crazy. The two economists would laugh, right? And you can imagine that folks in their department are deriding them, right? They aren't at their desks. They aren't working. And what they were doing, as it turns out, was they were rewriting the rules of economic theory as we know them. But work looked different than kind of conventional thinking would suggest. And in that chapter, there's a whole slew of examples of basically, you know, Steve Jobs used to say, think different. I like to say work different, you know, and if we really want to break through, we have to create new permissions and new language to allow people to see. Sometimes a walk is the very best thing you can do. And that is work. It's not that you're not working. It's that you're working different.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I think so much of the way we think about work is permeated by this industrial age notion of, you know, systematic throughput and Taylorist thinking and so forth. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, with the advent of things like AI, right, more and more of a premium is going to be put on human creativity than ever before. And we do need to learn to think differently. You talk about padding your schedule, which is another technique that I think is really, really practical. So kind of along those lines, I'd love it if you could share with our listeners the story of Jen versus Jim in the book.
Well, they're archetypes of sorts. And I mean, they're you know, quintessential, you know, canonical examples of exactly what we're talking about right now, right? Someone who is thoughtful and deliberate about their approach, Jen, to work and to problem solving, and someone who is reactive and always putting out fires. I would say 99% of people I speak to consider themselves to be Jim, not Jen. Everybody wants to get to be Jen, but it requires a radical shift. It requires actually exercising more agency. You know, I think most people, if you just look at the calendar, for example, going back to your notion of padding the calendar, most people say the reason they can't, you know, insert
whatever,
innovative behavior, right? Insert ideation, experimentation, collaboration, getting outside their field. Why can't you do any of those things? I don't have time. Mm-hmm. And the way we've pictured it, you know, recently in an HBR article that we wrote, I don't think this is in the book, but the way I've kind of pictured it is, it's almost like, you remember that game Tetris? Mm-hmm. There are these kind of pieces coming in, and I see our calendars that way. We've got these incoming pieces, and all we're trying to do is move them around and fit them all perfectly. And then we get these full chunks and we go, well, I don't have any time. I mean, I'll never forget. I think we said this in the book. There's this amazing example. We're advising a leadership team of a large technology company, globally distributed team, the 30 folks who report directly to the CEO, and this woman who's in Ireland, Anne. We'd given them a simple assignment just to run an experiment. They had 2 weeks to run an experiment. That doesn't mean spend millions of dollars. It means try something, very simply. And we gave parameters and guidelines, so it's not like we just threw in the deep end. But we said, run an experiment in the next couple of weeks. And when we got back together, we started the debrief, and I led off with her because she is my favorite. I said, Anne, tell us about your experiment. And she, I won't try to impersonate an Irish accent, but she said, sometimes I will, by the way. She said, Jeremy, I haven't had any time to run an experiment. And I said, what do you mean? You've had 2 weeks. And she said, Jeremy, it's Wednesday morning here in Ireland. This is my 32nd meeting of the week. She said, so when am I supposed to run an experiment? And I realized, oh, she's Jim. She's not Anne, she's Jim, right? And I said, okay, Anne, respectfully, I get it. Tell me about your calendar next week. She said, oh, it's crazy. I'm triple booked most time slots. What about the next week? That's a little bit less crazy. Okay, what about the next week? 3 weeks out. Oh, there's a little bit of daylight still there. Not everything's been gobbled up. I said, okay, right now, preemptively put a block on your calendar. She said, for what? I said, just double click. She double clicked. What should I call it? Time to experiment. And she said, but what's the experience? I said, you don't need to know. but when you get there, if you don't have the time, then what you'll say when you know you need to experiment is, I don't have time. So then I said, the next week, why don't you put another calendar block that says review data from experiment from last week, right? And I called that writing a love note to your future self.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because you're going to usually, I don't know about you, but oftentimes, I mean, the reason that I'm so familiar with this is I do the same thing, but I wake up and I look at my calendar and I hate past Jeremy. Like, why did that guy do this to me? You know, and for most knowledge workers, I would say there's for all that, you know, kind of coming full circle. We have far more autonomy over our calendars than we like to believe. I talked to someone who is the global COO of one of the largest fast food companies in the world. Okay. Beloved brand, thousands of locations worldwide. And he said he'll regularly block a 2-hour strategy session where he knows he's walking his dog and he's thinking. But if people see on his calendar, walk my dog and think, they'll book the time over it. If they see strategy session, nobody messes with it, right? But the point is, he's, and I think you go, well, he's a COO. Yeah, but at some point you have to own your own agency and say, if I'm not making time for the important things, nobody's going to make it for me.
Totally agree. And I find with myself, especially for writing, I just need to block that time. I was recently revising a book proposal that I'm working on for a new book, and had blocked 3 solid days to just do nothing but that. And it was a little painful. I mean, you know, my team was feeling kind of neglected. People needed responses to, like, are you available on August 17th? That kind of thing. And it all just had to wait for 3 days. So it did come at a little bit of a cost, but in the great scheme of things, not a big cost. And I literally spent day one of that whole 3 days just staring at a screen, trying to get head around.
It takes reacclimation. Yeah. You know, you've actually got to, you know, I love, there's one of my favorite lectures. It's actually one of my most engaged with pieces on LinkedIn. I'm not quite an influencer like you, but I have a little bit of follow. Anytime I see something gets like 10,000 views, that's really good for me. And I posted something, I just dashed. Usually I'm like very thoughtful and careful, and I get middling engagement. This time I just dashed off. I love this, this talk on creativity by John Cleese. Here's a couple of my favorite lines. And then I just sent it off. I got tons of engagement, and, you know, it's, which is to say, you never know what's actually going to, you know, capture people's imagination. But John Cleese, one of the things he talks about is you have to assume you've got to endure. There's a period of time where all of the items on your to-do list are pressing. You're trying to find any excuse, because what you want to gravitate towards is the urgent, but not important. The list of things that you can tick off and get done quickly, not the thing that you actually like for you, you know, you need to write this outline. You know, you need to write the proposal. All of a sudden you got to remember your dry cleaning and you got to remember that your dog needs and just really quickly, you got to make sure that the gutters are working, you know, and did I start the dishwasher? And I should make another pot of coffee. And before you know it, half the day's wasted. Right. And that's how it, and what John Cleese says is you have to allot yourself enough time that you get past all that. And you still have time to do the work that you said that you really wanted to do.
Exactly.
Anyway, I can't recommend, we can maybe drop that in the show notes or something. That video is a master class in creative leadership for sure.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And he please would know, right? I mean, he's absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think my tagline for 2023 so far is so many rabbit holes, so few rabbits.
That's good. That's a great one. I love that.
I'll have to patent that one, I think.
That's awesome.
So you have another thing I really like about the book is you're giving people lots and lots of ways to get going without a lot of time and without a lot of money invested. And so one of the techniques you talk about is a bug list. And how the invention of liquid paper, I did not know this, how the invention of liquid paper actually related to something that bugged a typist.
well, I mean, this is one of my favorite, first of all, let's start with the story and then I'll give the tactic. So mm-hmm. Bette Nesmith Graham, she's an innovative hero of mine. She's a single mom in the early 1950s. Her husband left after the war and she's raising a teenage son. She's working as a typist at Texas Bank and Trust. And she's constantly frustrated, as many secretaries of that era were, by this newfangled thing called a typewriter, which supposedly is meant to make her job easier. And yet for her, it drives her crazy because she spends half her time trying to erase these smudges that the carbon filament puts on the page. And so it ends up, maybe it saves a little bit of time, but then it adds a bunch of work and it's driving her crazy. And so that's like a well-known thing.
This is the electric typewriter.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And so she has to, because she's a single mom, she has to work kind of side hustles and weekend gigs and things like that to kind of make ends meet. And one weekend she's painting window displays at a department store and she made a mistake and she gets her straight edge razor out to kind of scrape it off the window when one of the painters runs over and he says, whoa, 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 whoa. What are you doing? And she said, I made a mistake. I'm just erasing this. And he said something that would change her life and it would change actually all of our lives. We just don't know it. He said, Bet, painters don't erase mistakes. Painters paint over their mistakes. And maybe for any other, call it apprentice on the job at the department store, they go, clever expression, whatever, get back to work. For her, she goes, that's what I should be doing back at my desk as a secretary. And because she was so frustrated by the typewriter and she was primed with this insight, she ended up working with her son's high school chemistry teacher to develop the formula and a local paint store employee to mix and get it right. She ended up developing what became liquid paper. And I mean, there was tons of perspiration, right? Inspiration, perspiration. But to me, you cannot discount the extent to which radically unexpected new cognitive input came in the form of a Lego called, you know, painters paint over mistakes, but then also how she had been uniquely primed by the problem, this persistent problem. Since the 1960s, professors in the design program at Stanford have been giving this assignment called keep a bug list. This is long before computer programming entered common parlance. We don't mean, you know, errors and lines of code. What we've meant is write down a list of the things that bug you. And what we've known and what we've seen over the years is some of the most delightful innovations come from folks who are attentive to the things that are annoying them, right? They write them down. And it turns out a problem is a necessary precondition to a solution. And if you don't know what solution to generate, start attending to problems, right? One of my favorite examples of this is, Spanx, of course, comes from Sarah Blakely's own intimate acquaintance with this frustration around pantyhose as she was a door-to-door saleswoman of fax machines, right? You look at the Nest thermostat. You know why Tony Fadell created that? It's because he owned a house in Tahoe while he worked at Apple developing the iPod and then later the iPhone. And he says in his book, he was really annoyed that every time he arrived in Tahoe on Friday night, he and his wife would have to huddle up under one sleeping bag. They could see their breath. It was so stinking cold in their condo, but they couldn't turn on the heat until they got there. So it wasn't actually warm until Saturday morning every time. Right. And so what does he do? He reinvents the thermostat. But the point is, a lot of times, you know, aspiring entrepreneurs start with a TAM, right? And they start with like some big aspirational goal rather than what's a really annoying problem I want to solve? What problem do I feel personally? And starting to kind of cultivate an awareness to problems to solve ends up priming your mind to generate novel solutions.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other mistakes that I see a lot of entrepreneurs make is they'll go and they'll ask people directly, you know, would you buy this thing? Right. You know, right. I've got this really cool thing that advances slides. Would you buy it? And people are polite right. And they all say, right. Yes, of course. Right. And in the book, you have this delightful story about the fourth level unused space in this big shopping mall and the attempts to figure out whether or not putting a bigger garden up there would solve the problem.
Right. No, I that's really quickly, once you have an idea, the question comes, how do I know if it's a good idea? And certainly you should talk to customers. Certainly you should engage the target market, et cetera. But the question is how? And for most people, you know, and I spent part of my life as a management consultant, walking around with a clipboard and puppy dog eyes, asking, you know, interrupting people in the food court. Excuse me, sir, would you mind if I ask you a couple questions? I grew up in Texas. And so he'd say, well, sure, buddy. And I'd ask him my questions. Excuse me, ma'am, can I ask you a couple questions? Right. And that was data. Right. And what I know is not, and that's not, it's not to cast aspersions, but it's fabricated data. You know, and so in the example of the mall, you know, the backstory is a large real estate company in Australia has got malls all over the world. And in one of their city center malls, they had an underperforming fourth floor, which was kind of confusing to them because this floor had, you know, amazing fresco ceilings and panoramic views of the city. And yet retailers were moving out because there wasn't enough foot traffic to the fourth floor. And so the brainstorm kind of subject was, how do we drive foot traffic to the fourth floor? And one of the inspired solutions that came out of that session pretty quickly was, let's put a beer garden up there. You know, can you imagine the startup titans of the city ascending the escalator and, you know, sipping ambrosia and, you know, looking over their kingdom? It sounds great, right? And so they actually went down to the food court and they surveyed people. And you picture me, puppy dog eye intern. Excuse me, sir, would you mind to let me know if we put a beer garden up on the fourth floor, would you come up there? You know, and you say, put me down for a yes, buddy, right? Yes. And excuse me, ma'am, I hate to interrupt you, but we're thinking about putting a beer garden up there on four. Would you come up there? You know what? Yeah, buddy, sure. Tell your bosses I said yes, right? Well, you can imagine how that goes. They survey the customers in the first floor, and something like 85% of over 1,000 people they talked to said, yeah, we'd come to a beer garden. And the conventional corporate wisdom is 85% said yes. Like, what does it cost to retrofit this space? A couple $1 million? Let's do it. And we'll buy some Herman Miller chairs. We'll just, you know, zhuzh it a little and let's go, right? Thankfully, they had been through some of our training. We'd actually worked with the leadership team, and they knew responses to surveys could be problematic, right? And so what we suggest they do is they create a different kind of data. Very simply, they should create decision data. Decisions are much more predictive of behavior than sentiment. And so we said to the team, you need to create a believable decision for people and then see what they do, right? Prior to investing millions of dollars to retrofit the space.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, importantly, right? Don't wait till you retrofit the space to advertise the fact that you want to put this up there. Advertise it. And that's what they did. They actually advertised it all over the mall. They put a handful of interns upstairs with, you know, coupons and beer pitchers and things like that, right? But there's no actual beer garden.
Right.
It doesn't matter if what happened was nobody comes up there. Everybody, there's signs everywhere. Visit the fourth floor. No, over a month, you know, less than 20 people visited the fourth floor, I think. And what they're able to do is they say, wow, despite the fact that 85% of people we talked to said they would love it, Was it because they felt bad for the puppy dog eyed intern?
Of course.
Was it, you know, exactly right. It's not because they actually, it's because if it costs someone nothing to lie to you, they will lie to you rather than hurt your feelings. Exactly. You know, and it's not that they're malicious. It's not that they're evil. It's that it's really uncomfortable to look a puppy dog eyed intern with a clipboard in the face and say their boss's idea is no good.
Right.
Like nobody wants to be that guy, right? Right? It's like not when you got chicken nuggets and pizza and your kids, you know, it's just like, yeah, buddy, put me down for a yeah, right? But that's the way that a lot of this data gets created. And when you're asking the question, should I resource and commission multi-million dollar new investment, you really shouldn't ride that decision on data that's collected in that manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You also talk about the man crate, I think.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, John Beekman is
one. Pardon me, I hate to do this. I've got to go answer the doorbell. I'll
be right back. No, it's fine. Should I just tell the story while you're gone?
Tell the story while I'm doing that.
You read it in the book, right? This is reality, folks. People have doorbells. People have lives. And I see some comments here. I'm hoping, Gary, that was funny. Good pun, by the way. I'm hoping to get to address some of these comments later. The story about John is he was a standout student in our class at Stanford called Launchpad. And he had a new venture called that he had imagined in his mind called Man Crates, which was basically gift baskets built for men. So that are intended for a male audience that aren't cheesy, but that are really fun and kind of snarky. And the kind of the core feature of the crate was there's no way to get into it except with the crowbar that it comes with. And you basically have to break into your crate. Okay. So this is, I still remember the first crowbar he built. I love it.
I love that. That's great.
But what John did, it was really clever, is instead of investing in a bunch of inventory, which is, you know, think about the stuff he's putting in these crates. It's Cheetos, it's Tums, you know, he's got like an indigestion crate, which is hysterical, right?
Please tell me he had a hangover crate.
Oh, he had every kind of crate you can imagine. Yes. And the beauty of his model, actually, as you know, Rita, is he could test all these things, right? So he envisioned all these different kinds of crates, but rather than investing in the inventory, you know, to basically fulfill a bunch of orders, he just bought enough inventory to take a picture. And then he put the picture up on the website, and then he ran Facebook ads and Twitter ads and Instagram ads against these really nice photos. But he literally, at one point, he had one crate. He would put the same crate in every photo and then, you know, merchandise it all, take a picture, move the merchandise, but leave the crate because it's the only one he has. And he's technically incapable of actually shipping anything. But he started running ads so that he would understand what crates resonate with the market. Because what he realized is he's going to have a lot of working capital tied up in inventory, and he can't afford to buy a bunch of Cheetos if nobody wants the Flamin' Hot crate or whatever it is. Right? he's going to go out of business. It's bad. You know, he's raising friends and family funds. You know, should Aunt Melba's, you know, $5,000 be spent on Cheetos that are going to expire on the shelf? You know, these are like real considerations, right? And so he started doing that. Well, then what he realized is over time, this is fascinating. One of his other big opportunity as he got in business, you know, he became one of Inc.com's fastest growing companies. And he realized subsequently that his other big risk was not investing in enough inventory. If an item really popped, he needed to be able to ship a lot of it. And if he didn't buy enough Cheetos, he's basically leaving money on the table. And so then he started using, he called it kind of a ghost product strategy, where at any given time on his website, there were two or three products that he actually couldn't fulfill. He technically didn't have the inventory, but he was tracking. He knew that there are different measures like add to cart, for example, that were highly correlated enough with a purchase that if he saw the kind of leading indicator, it would give him confidence to invest in sufficient inventory for a new product launch. But it's a great simple example. And what he did was, by the way, every person who placed an order, immediately the order was canceled, he would immediately call them. He would talk to them. He'd say, I'm the CEO of this new startup. Almost 100% of people were thrilled to have a CEO of a startup call them. And then he would give them a discount on their next order. And he's actually tracked this data. The people, the early customers whose orders got canceled are to this day some of the most loyal customers of the business. So lest you think that you're destroying relationships here, you're definitely not. It's all in how you handle it, right? Because what he needs to know is, are people going to buy? And then whenever people indicate they want to buy, quickly he says, I have nothing to sell you, but I'd love to talk to you to understand, who are you shopping for? And what led you here? And what problem are you trying to solve? Right. And he's able to get into these rich conversations, not with random people on the street, but with people who are actually compelled by his offer.
I love that. I also really want to emphasize for our listeners the importance of these leading indicators. That, you know, way too often what we're looking at is lagging indicators, you know, great information about stuff that's already happened, when what we really need to be thinking about is, you know, what are the metrics that you could start to track that predict whether a certain kind of behavior, a certain kind of outcome is going to happen. I love the book. So could you elaborate a little on, you got this idea quota, and you increase your idea quota concept. So seeding it, sleeping on it, and solving it. And I love the notion of, this is another practical tip I thought was great in the book, is like before you go to bed at night, like just frame up in your mind a thorny problem you're trying to solve and let your brain deal with it overnight.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that before.
No, you know, Reid Hoffman says, I never go to sleep without giving my subconscious a problem to work on.
Really?
Which I love. Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I think Steinbeck said, you know, there's very few challenges which are not quite, which seem as pressing once the committee of sleep has convened, right? Something like that, right? But anyway, the basic notion of an idea quota, and there are different ways to prime it, which we kind of lay out in the book. The basic notion of an idea quota is recognizing your instinct or your tendency is to try to come up with the right answer. The reality is very few of the problems we're facing, most of us aren't mathematicians, right? The problems we're facing don't have a single right answer. And if you look at kind of the cognitive biases at play in problem solving, there's a bias, for example, called the Einstein effect, which has been demonstrated that for a problem solver, when they identify a potential solution, they become fixated on that solution and they become blinded to better solutions, actually. And this was first identified by Abraham Lutyens in the 1940s. And there's been a recent study at Oxford, fascinating, on chess players, masters and novices, fall prey to the Einstein effect. And one simple way to short circuit it, Abraham Lutyens called it introducing an interrupt. But one simple way to short circuit the Einstein effect, which is to say the tendency to fixate on the first plausible seeming solution, is to shift the goal from coming up with the answer to a quantity, to a quota. And we got the idea of a quota from Thomas Edison, actually, who gave himself an invention quota. He had a quota of one minor invention every 10 days, one major invention every 6 months. And we just like that idea of, like, there's some kind of accountability there. And so we say, okay, every day, once a day, you should take a problem. And instead of trying to come up with the right answer, generate at least 10 possible answers. Could be 10 wacky answers. It doesn't matter. But you're shifting your goal from the right answer to a volume of possible answers. And it's not just, I mean, it can be for work. I'll give you a personal example. My life, the other day, we live in a house that was built in 1908. And as I've mentioned before, I have four daughters. And they don't always obey the household rules. I hate to say it. I hate to say it, but they're not perfectly behaved yet. We're working on it. And the other day, they slammed the door, you know, for the approximately 47,000th time. And the 115-year-old window shattered. Okay. So it's irreplaceable. And there's glass everywhere. And the question is, what do we do? You know, and my wife and I are standing in the kitchen, we're talking about, what are we going to do? And really quickly, just like any other problem, it's like this ever narrowing kind of tunnel vision of, like, well, how long are we going to take away the iPad? You know, and that all of a sudden our whole conversation, is it 2 weeks? Is it 3 weeks? You know? And I said, Michelle, we should do an idea quota. Of course, my wife first rolled her eyes. She's like, idea flow right now. And I'm like, yeah, it'll help, right?
It's the book.
She's like, okay, we'll do an idea quota. And it didn't take us any longer than we were hemming and hawing in the kitchen, by the way. But I just said, instead of trying to find the right answer, let's just generate 10. And I actually built a little chat bot. That's an overstatement, but we can share a link to it if you want. But I built a little chat bot to just kind of help walk me through, because sometimes I need help getting out of my own head. And we walked through the chat bot, lo and behold, the 10th idea is way better than take away your iPad, right? The 10th. And I've actually done this now, you know, in the last quarter at Stanford, I had students do an idea quota every single day, and they had to fill out a questionnaire every day. So I've got, you know, 1,000 responses to this questionnaire. You'll love this, Rita. Here's a quiz for you, the professor. I ask students every day to say, you know, what your problem was, what the solution was, and what number the solution was. Was it, and the first solution is always, what's, like, the chatbot basically does something like this. What's the problem you're trying to solve today, Rita? You'll say. What's the obvious answer? You'll say. What's the opposite of that? You'll say. What would the Olive Garden do if it were their problem? I'm making this up. What would Tom Brady do if it was his problem? What would Serena Williams do if it was her problem? What would, you know, it just runs through a bunch of kind of, you know, okay, different frames, right? And then I ask people the question, what number was your favorite solution? Okay. So here's a question for you. What percent of people's favorite solution was the obvious solution, the first solution that came to their mind?
Oh, I would say virtually zero, right?
It's under 4%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Under 4%.
That's so amazing.
And yet it's the obvious solution that most people would have gone forward with had they not been given the prompt to generate alternatives. And what that research indicates, 96% of the time, you're well served to at least push yourself beyond the first thing. By the way, more favorite solutions come beyond the 10th than the first.
Really?
Yeah, something like 7% of people's favorite solution is after the 10th.
That's so cool. So we have a question in the chat about the corporate environment full of, you know, highly paid, highly opinionated people. In the book, I mean, you don't just talk about the ideas and things. You also have a fair amount of, by the way, for those just joining, the book is Idea Flow, and it's all about how to get great ideas. But you talk in the book a lot about the leaders that enable the conditions for this process to play out, right? So not pushing people to come up with the right answer, like, on the spot, and giving dissonant voices the chance to be heard. Like, you have an example about the hotel company where, you know, everybody's marching along and we're all happy campers. We did this design workshop and it was awesome. And this one woman kind of says, actually, I like, it didn't work for me. Like, this is not my thing.
Right. Well, and also, I mean,
how the leader made that environment possible.
I mean, Amy Edmondson, who's our mutual friend, I think she's so eloquently spoken on psychological safety and the importance there. I mean, the simplest way, this is not to do justice to Amy's research at all or to simplify at all. I find one kind of a good diagnostic question that any leader can ask is, when's the last time someone shared a stupid idea with me?
Love it.
If you want to just kind of do a quick, and I haven't verified this with Amy, right? I'd welcome her feedback if she hears this. But if you want to know if you have a psychologically safe environment, just ask yourself, when's the last time that somebody shared a stupid idea with you? And for most leaders that I talk to, you know, I've asked that question hundreds of times. I generally get one of two answers. One is, yeah, that's a great question. It's been a long time since someone shared a stupid idea with me. And I say, that's awesome. Thank you. Please, you know, you got work to do. They go, I know. The other answer is, all the time. People are always sharing stupid ideas with me. In which case I say, you're a jerk. That's not what I meant. I meant, when's the last time someone shared an idea they thought was stupid with you? Not an idea that you thought was stupid. And if you're walking around as a boss going, dumb idea, dumb idea, dumb idea, dumb idea, you're a jerk. If you've created, you know, and we tell the story of my dad. My dad's a corporate litigator. He's a world-class, you know, litigator. And we tell the story because we were talking about this, one of the chapters of the book, we talk about perspectives. And one of the perspectives we emphasize is that of novices and how beneficial a novice perspective is on a problem because they aren't attached to conventional wisdom and conventional paradigms, right? Not to go down that rabbit hole. Too many holes, not enough rabbits. But I was telling him, because my dad was, he was visiting out here. He's asking me, hey, what are you working on? I was telling him about the chapter, and I said, have you ever seen that, you know, with novices? And he goes, oh, all the time. I said, really? In law, tell me about, you know, that's an area where expertise is kind of paramount. And he said, actually, I mean, you know, that case we just won before the Supreme Court, they'd recently won a case before the Supreme Court. He said, do you know where that stream of logic came from. It actually came from a young attorney on our team. I said, really? Tell me more. And he said, well, we were really stuck on this case. And he said, this young lady who hadn't been at our firm for more than 18 months, he said, she hardly knew where the fax machine was, to which, of course, I said, Dad, you guys use a fax machine? He said, shut up. He said, she walked into my office and she shut the door and she said, okay, Mr. Utley, either I'm about to say the dumbest thing a lawyer's ever said, or I think I found a way for us to win the case. And he said, that bonehead who didn't know where the filing cabinets were, found a way for us to win the case. And I said, okay, Dad, setting aside the novice thing, what did you do to make it safe for an 18-month attorney to walk into your office and say, I've got to say something that might be the dumbest thing a lawyer's ever said, right? And to me, that is a great example of that diagnostic. When's the last time somebody was willing to put themselves out there? That is an indication of how psychologically safe you have made it as a leader to innovate, because innovation is about variation. Mm-hmm. And if folks can't have bad ideas, they're never going to have good ideas.
Absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I love the sort of imagery of bringing different buckets of Lego blocks together. And one of the most entertaining stories to me in the book was about taking this group of button down people from Fidelity Investments to go visit Urban Outfitters.
One of my favorite experiences in my life, actually. That's the thing. I mean, it's a beginner's mindset, something that you have to decide. And it's actually amazing once you unlock it, because, you know, I'll never forget. I was standing with this very experienced executive. She said, I've been here hundreds of times with my daughter. I'm not going to see anything new. And our belief is that there's we define inspiration as the disciplined pursuit of unexpected input. And unexpected is important because that's what triggers your imagination. You actually have to have unexpected input in order for your imagination to get firing. And so a question you can ask if you don't understand, in this case, right, we were trying to understand young folks and why they aren't opening savings accounts. And one question you can ask is, well, who understands young folks? What's an environment where young folks love to go? And then we made a list of places. And then you can say, well, what do they know about them that we don't? Yeah. And you come in assuming good intent, as moderators might say, don't assume they're making bad decisions. Like, look for the weird stuff and project meaning onto it and design intention that may be outside of your understanding. Right. And so we actually went to Urban Outfitters, which she had been there a bunch with her daughter. And I said, okay, hang on, but don't tell me what you've already seen before. We're just going to sit here and we're going to be silent. And I want you to look for weird stuff and then try to explain it as insightful, as if Urban Outfitters intended it. Right. And it took about 20 minutes before she kind of, like, she caught her breath. And I said, what are you seeing? And she said, you see that girl over there? And I see this young woman, she's got like pink and purple hair, you know, on her hands and knees, rummaging under this kind of merchandise display. And I have to use air quotes because it's hardly a display. And I said, yeah, I see her. And she said, that's very poor merchandising, isn't it? I said, yeah, I think so too. She said, we would never do that. And I said, but what does that tell you? If you assume Urban Outfitters knows something about her that you don't know, what do they know? And she said, she wants a treasure hunt. And I said, wow. Yeah, that's, by the way, I'd been to Urban Outfitters a bunch of times and I hadn't thought about that, right? But I go, what are the implications of a treasure hunt? What would it look like to design a 401k where you felt like nobody else could ever discover what you discovered, right? You know, just, and those kinds of radical reorientations towards the market and towards the customer require you to take on that beginner's mindset, even if you've seen something 1,000 times. And for a lot of people, especially in leadership roles, it requires a deliberate shedding of layers of insulation and expertise that they've developed over a long period of time, because the world's changing and expertise is increasingly a liability in a changing environment.
I mean, one of the projects I've been working on recently with a large pharmaceutical company is looking at the advances into healthcare of the tech firms. And what's fascinating is they know all there is to know about healthcare as it is, but they know a lot about technology. Mm-hmm. And so if you believe that, and as I do, that the future of healthcare is going to have a big hefty dose of a lot of stuff coming in from the technological side, that's a huge blind spot, right? And and a big liability potentially. So we've got them now studying, you know, how do people use technology and what happens when technology devolves to the home and those kinds of things. So I would be remiss if our time runs out before saying you don't just talk about this stuff, as in writing great books and stuff. You're actually doing it. Would you be willing to talk about your startup?
Well, so you're talking about FreeSpin, yes? Yeah. By the way, anyone who asks which startup when someone says you want to talk about your startup, you know that they're in trouble. So because I'm involved in a number of initiatives.
Oh, are you? Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
It's a lot of fun. It's an exciting life. Yeah. I mean, for me, the privilege of having been able to stand on the shoulders of giants and learn this stuff is now I feel I actually have a responsibility to steward and to find opportunities to innovate myself. And one of those opportunity areas is a venture capital mechanism called FreeSpin Ventures, where we're basically identifying underutilized corporate assets and spinning them into new ventures that service a market. So you look at kind of a back office function that services an existing enterprise, but that the enterprise has never really thought about monetizing or commercializing. Usually what's lacking, by the way, that's a great evidence of product market fit. If an enterprise has built a technology to solve its own problem, you've already got evidence of product market fit there,
yes,
right?
I love that.
What the enterprise usually lacks is two things. One is risk capital, right? And so we bring venture capital to the table because the investment kind of prospects of that new technology are radically different than kind of reinvestment in the existing lines of business. And then the second is entrepreneurial talent. And so we've got a network of entrepreneurs who we can deploy against new opportunities like this. But so what we end up doing is we spin out that solution as a new entity that the enterprise holds equity in, but importantly also becomes a customer of. And then with venture capital and with new entrepreneurial talent, we continue to service the enterprise and deliver in most cases, much better service than they were getting when it was an internal function. But then that new function is actually able to service the rest of the marketplace as well. And so for the enterprise, what they're basically doing is they're turning effective rent payments into mortgage payments, meaning they're still making payments, but instead of just kind of paying to use the space, they're actually building equity in an asset whose value is growing over time with that same investment.
Oh, I love that. It's a very bright idea, I think, and very practical. And I think a lot of companies would find that to be really attractive, because the other thing that happens if they try to commercialize it themselves, you have this mismatch of scale. Like, I'll never forget, there was a guy at DuPont who had this idea of taking a material that was built into carpeting, for example, to keep it from getting stains. I forget what the material was. And he was very entrepreneurial. So he got a license from DuPont to sell this stuff. He had like an office over a drugstore in downtown. He took the mail to the post office by himself. And he built this business up to be, I think it was like a $2 million revenue business. So that's really good, right? For you and I, that's amazing. And then DuPont had some kind of cost downsizing, and they forced him back to corporate headquarters, and now he's got to pay rent on the space, and now he's got to use all the corporate shared services. And he went from a $2 million with practically 90% profit to like a $4 million loss, and then they ended up shutting it down.
Right, right.
It's got this scale mismatch when companies try to commercialize this stuff for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, there are occasions where it makes sense, obviously, but I would say there are many more occasions where the very best thing is to get it outside of the existing structure of the enterprise and to give it fresh capital, fresh talent. The kind of talent that's required to go, you know, call it 1 to 10, 1 to 100 is radically different. And the instinct of the organization is to think in terms of super scale. And that almost always will suffocate a nascent venture.
So what are some of the biggest things you think people get wrong about kind of design and entrepreneurship? What are some of the, like, if you had a David Letterman top 10 list, what would some of the things on that list be?
Oh, you know, one of my favorite ones, which I learned from my friend Dan Klein, who's a Stanford improviser guru, is your job isn't to be creative. Your job is to be obvious. And so what you want to do in the context of a team is you want to create an environment where it's safe for everybody to be their obvious self. And when everybody comes in thinking that, oh, sorry, getting a FaceTime call there. When everybody comes in thinking their job is to be creative or to have the bright idea, that's that spells doom for the team. When everyone sees, all I have to do is be free to say what comes to my mind next, and then trust no one's going to judge me. And that's going to spin the conversation in a way that none of us could have predicted, because then they're going to say they're next and they're next and they're next. That to me is one of the most counterintuitive ways to get to breakthroughs. Dare to be obvious would be one of my top recommendations.
Oh, I love that. And so often what I hear, after the thing's been demonstrated, people look back and they go, well, of course, that's obvious, right? But before, figuring that out in advance, that's a much different proposition. So yes. Jeremy Utley works with companies, has a role at the Stanford Design School, serial entrepreneur, involved in a bunch of ventures. How do people get to be part of your world? How do they learn more?
Yeah, thank you, Rita, for asking. I've got a blog that I try to keep up on a weekly basis, a newsletter that I send out just at my website, jeremyutley.design. I'm fairly active on LinkedIn, not as active as you are, Rita. You're an inspiration to me. And Twitter. And if folks are interested in FreeSpend, you can check out freespend.vc as well, where that mechanism, be happy to talk with folks. And then my email is also, publicly available, but you can email me jeremyutley@gmail.com. I'd be happy to chat with anybody who's curious about these topics. So I would say origin stories are my love language. So if you want to find your way to my heart, tell me an origin story of innovation or an invention or something. And that's to me, it's better than a cup of coffee. It's better than anything. And I've had many people strike up friendships with me by saying, hey, you know where the post-it note came from? And then it's like, we're off to the races, right? So I've just given you the keys to my heart.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thank you for spending the hour with us. And I look forward to our next conversation. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thank you,
Rita. Have a great weekend, everybody.